In the midst of this global crisis, the voices for justice are revealing what really matters. It is time for Planetary Makeover.
Greetings, everyone. We're doing something a little different for this episode of Planetary Makeover. We're featuring what this host considers a sister show from our friends at Share International Canada, produced in conjunction with some of their American co-workers. This show is called What in the World is Happening? And is a live stream that takes place weekly, every Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, with co-hosts Sabina Qureshi and Tim Butskis. This is their 52nd episode, entitled In the Midst of Crisis, Great Teachers Are Emerging to Help Humanity. The return of a great teacher is a common theme found in the chronicles of the great religions and indigenous traditions. What if this event has already taken place? To get notifications about this show, follow hashtag Share International Canada on Facebook. That's hashtag Share International Canada on Facebook.
Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of What in the World is Happening? We're back again this week to talk about the Masters and Maitreya, the Masters of Wisdom, and to put that in the context of the crises that we're all going through and living across the globe. I'm Sabina Qureshi, broadcasting from Edmonton, Alberta, and with me are Tim Butskis, also in Edmonton. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Sabina. Hi, everyone.
And Michael Tails, also in Edmonton. Hi, Mike. I think you're muted still. And we're going to recap a bit what we did last week to just briefly cover the crises that we talked about and then jump into a lot of what humanity is doing, what we are doing in the face of these crises. There are projects going on all over the world that really raise hope and show a path forward. And it's a very inspiring time to be alive right now. So we're just going to carry on and go straight to the crises. Sort of we've encapsulated it like this. Of course, there are many ways you could describe these crises, but we've just made a short list here. Environmental, humanitarian, economic, political, health crises, spiritual crises. And we don't want to go into a lot of detail about these the way we did last week, but we do want to mention them briefly. And I think, Mike, were you the one that was talking about environmental crises last time?
Yeah, we just, like you said, we'll just touch on this. I'm sorry, my mic was a little bit frozen there. I had to get it the host had to undo it for me there, so thank you. The environmental crisis. Well, last week we talked about Greta Thunberg. The reason why I started with her was because I felt any, 17-year-old who could go across the ocean, some of our listeners will remember, on a little, well, the media called it a yacht, but the truth was it was a racing boat. So it was very, very uncomfortable. There are very few teenagers that would sacrifice their cell phone, let alone that experience, in the Western world, the developed world. So, and she is from the developed world, and she made that huge sacrifice across the ocean in order to try to draw attention to the environmental crisis that we're all facing.
And she's been very successful because the environment is now really at the top of the list of many people's priorities for action. And we've seen Joe Biden's administration take major steps in that direction. So really there's a huge shift in public awareness. And that's one of the things that we want to mention as well, is that humanity, we are advancing in the sense of awareness of what we're able to understand and encompass in our awareness. And that's a very important aspect. And Tim, you were going to talk about the humanitarian crises, right?
We talked about humanitarian crises last time, of course. There's all of these examples of really horrific conditions with refugees, mass exodus, starvation, people who are caught, armed conflict, Yemen, Somalia. I mean, there are tons of them. And we talked about the globalization without any sort of recognition of humanity, of our needs and rights. So just globalizing without any anything about social justice. So I was thinking about this morning, you know, corporations have this bottom line, you know, you always have to preserve the bottom line. How about a new bottom line where we coordinate global assistance and prioritizing human dignity? So if we made that the bottom line, we could maybe make some huge steps to resolving these humanitarian crises.
Yeah, just like Tim said, that economic situation that with a corporation making those choices based on profit margins and ensuring the profit margin is always sacrosanct. It's sacred. We keep it sacred. We protect it at all costs. We just increase the costs of every item, and putting the squeeze on the regular human being does create a humanitarian crisis and an economic crisis, which I think is yours, Sabina, right?
That's right. And I wanted to mention, we haven't put up a slide for this, but there are many organizations right now that are working to combat the social injustice of the type of economic system that we have right now. Just to name one, there's a group called the Center for Economic and Social Rights, and they've been working for 25 years fighting for social justice through human rights, and they're focused on the economy. So there are lots of groups working on this right now across the world, but it's clear that the system itself is rotten. As you've been saying, it doesn't prioritize human life or any of the conditions needed to have a proper life. And so what we see are people who are left destitute, who are left simply to struggle and in many cases die because they're lacking the most basic elements for life. So it's a crisis of huge proportions. And the thing is that this is not a new crisis. We've been experiencing this for decades. And I think the difference now is that it's been heightened and exacerbated by the increasing power of corporations. And our awareness of it has been heightened by our global media. So the two things in tandem are leading to a real confrontation and a sense that enough is enough, and we're not going to put it up with it anymore.
Well, so on the political crisis front.
The farmers in India, right? I mean, that's a big thing that they're stepping up and saying no to the government for the type of law that was passed by the Narendra Modi's government just recently. And it's a new, well, it's not that protests in India are new, but I think it's new that people who have been considered such a kind of backbone of the society, that they're stepping up and saying no. And that's just one face of it, that picture there. You might have wanted to add, Mike.
Just part of that recap, too, on the political crisis was the fact that a lot of the politicians of the world are I feel anyway, gradually waking up, especially with the pandemic's intensity, that they have a role to play looking after their people. I know it's surprising. After all, it's in some republics like the United States or slash democracy or around the world where politicians are actually elected by the people and hence they're supposed to look after the people and the needs of the people. But I don't really personally, it's my opinion, see a lot of that as in the 20th and certainly not the 21st century. And I feel that, you know, that's a great example of the political crisis when they don't recognize that they're actually elected to serve, which is an honor to serve your fellow human being because, you know, God is in everyone and everything. And if I could go out on a limb and say something like that. And so essentially that's who you're serving. And it's a great opportunity in politics. And I feel that's part of the crisis that politicians specifically are facing, and obviously the public who elect them.
Well, and also if you look at the word civil servant, right? We even call people in government civil servants, servants of society.
You know? Yeah.
And of course, the health crises, we are well aware of the pandemic. And like Sabina was saying, the magnitude of these crises, the global aspect, and also the awareness, it's no longer a regional or national thing. So these crises are global, and made me think about as far as health, you know, a health crisis, there's such thing as a crisis would be a turning point for good or bad, right? A health crisis in healing is a healing crisis is when the body is detoxing and has a purge. It sort of purges to find equilibrium or homeostasis, a purge to attain a higher level of health. And so if you look at the world as a whole, you could look at this conglomeration of crises as sort of a turning point and a kind of a healing crisis to look at how we've been doing things and what we want to create in the future.
That's right. I agree with Tim. Like that holistic point of view is like the whole is treated in holistic medicine. The cause is treated in holistic medicine. And that's exactly, I agree with Tim, is they look at the whole and they see there's a crisis point. And interestingly enough, I just want to put in this part about fevers. Fevers tend to be exactly that. It's like the body working through a crisis. And then it comes out the other side, and people who have children recognize this, that when their children go through a fever experience and they come out, they're a little bit different. And so I'm really looking forward to that for humanity. I think if we could come through this and not go back to the way things were, but rather create a world, you know, because we are the architects of our world, this would be, I feel, a really great opportunity to come out of the health crisis.
Absolutely. I think one of the keys is looking at the whole, right, as in a holistic approach. If we look at the whole planet, our entire one humanity, we'll find the key.
Well, and the health crisis can almost be connected with the environmental crisis as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because our health depends on the environment. We can't live without it. And here's spiritual crises. Oh, sorry, Mike, you wanted to say something.
No, I was just going to say you just segued beautifully into spiritual crisis.
Right, the whole, right? We are connected to all of life, and we know that on some intrinsic deep level, and yet our system is set up to separate us from each other, from the world around us. And so I think the spiritual crisis is not only one in which is taking place within the religions of the world, where people are seeing that their leaders, their religious leaders, are failing them, and their religious institutions are failing them. But it's a crisis on a much deeper level than that. It's within each one of us in terms of our identity and our sense of belonging and our sense of connection with each other and with the world. So it's a really fundamental crisis that perhaps englobes all of the others, because really, depending on how you see yourself, that's going to determine your actions and your choices. And so, you know, until now, on some level, we could say our economic and political systems have told us that who we are cogs in a machine, and someone else is in charge of the machine. And the shift right now, the paradigm shift, is that people are saying that's not so. Each of us is a hologram, in a sense. We contain everything within ourselves, and we are in everything. So there's a sense of interconnectedness that people are now affirming. And we see that in the movements arising around the world and in the work that people are doing around the world. And that's what we want to talk about next. How could we solve these crises and in on the ground, practical terms? And so something that came up was universal basic income. Tim, I think you were going to talk about how that first...
Well, I think we're going to look a bit at the historic aspect, right, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, could universal income... I mean, we're talking about resolving these crises, looking at human dignity, everyone is sacred. How can we equalize things a bit, put people on a more fair playing field, if you will, and respecting that interconnectedness. So universal basic income is not necessarily new. It was written by Sir Thomas More in the 16th century in Utopia, talking about every citizen having a basic income. And it wasn't dependent on a work requirement or a means tester. It was just basically a basic income. There were a few others that wrote at that time about it as well, but one was more of a charity thing where you had to prove your willingness to work in order to get that kind of income. So they started, but it started to flesh out at that time and has continued over the centuries. I think, Mike, you've got a few things to add on that.
I do. Yeah. And okay. So Dennis and Mabel Milner, that's their name. They're a married couple in the Labour Party, but the year is 1918.
Labour Party in the UK?
In the United Kingdom. So thank you. In 1918, so they published a short pamphlet, and it was called The Scheme of State Bonus. Their pamphlet argued, for the introduction of an income paid unconditionally on a weekly basis to all citizens of the United Kingdom. They considered it a moral right for everyone to have the means to subsistence, and thus it should not be conditional on work or willingness to work. And that was their first, they made this huge argument in Parliament in London for that. And that was their, this, but I just want to say the whole idea was a moral right for everyone to have the means.
And what year was this, Mike?
It was 1918.
So, and, time of the Spanish flu.
Which is exactly what I, thank you so much, Sabina. The link, the paradox here, in the sense of how people are resisting UBI or, you know, is that sort of thing, and some that are fighting for it, is the same thing that was going on back then, as you just said.
Wonderfully during the pandemic.
Yeah, the pandemic. So they faced their own pandemic.
Was this a response to the pandemic, or was it just...
Well, the notes I have did not actually say, but that was existing, as we know, at that time. And but of course, they didn't have global media. They didn't have the ability to reach around and hear what other people are doing and try to do things about it. But this, I would, in my opinion, it's quite a coincidence. So there's another point from 1960s, the American president, Lyndon B. Johnson, made. And that was the war on poverty, not Ronald Reagan's war on drugs, but rather the war on poverty. So his prime political issue, Johnson believed in expanding the federal government, its roles in education and healthcare, which, as we know, we've seen debated and worked through in the United States for quite some time. So roles in education, healthcare, as poverty reduction strategies. In this political climate, the idea of a guaranteed income for every American also took root.
Well, and I see that John, our chat host, has just put a really wonderful quote in the chat by Martin Luther King Jr. from 1967. I am now convinced that the simplest approach will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a new, widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income. Yes.
And the guaranteed income is really, I think, something we have to look forward to in the world.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't, there's no reason why people shouldn't be guaranteed their basic needs. It's like a crazy making idea that we're born and yet, no, you're not guaranteed food every day.
Which is contrary to the family unit. So it's interesting you brought up, Sabina, under the spiritual crisis recap, our institutions are crumbling because they do not reflect who we are anymore. Humanity is not that. We don't agree with segregation all around us. So yeah, we look and we see everything appears separate, but more and more we're discovering that that's not the truth. Actually, the truth is quite opposite, that we're all one. We're all one in this pandemic. There's no segregation based on anything. You're a human being, you're suffering. So, and the institutions are crumbling because why? They need to reflect our new values. And that's what we're going to build. Humanity's going to build institutions that reflect, well, perhaps universal basic income will be a part of that new economic structure that would
There are lots of groups trying it right now across the world. Lots of pilot programs. This is probably not a complete list, but it's what I was able to find on the internet.
It's an amazing list.
And really, these are all projects taking place now. Some of them have been shortened and are no longer active. For example, the one in Ontario, Canada. And some, like I think in Finland as well, that one's over. But many of them are ongoing right now. And we're seeing a lot of interesting results from giving people the assurance of a guaranteed basic income. And I want to mention just briefly one of the projects, excuse me, and this was in North Carolina, was it? North Carolina. This this took place. This wasn't actually a guaranteed basic income pilot project, but it was a similar experience for the people involved. It was members of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in the Great Smoky Mountains. They had a casino built on their reservation. And from that time on, every citizen earned a share of the profits, which meant about an extra $4,000 a year per person, which is not a lot. However, what happened was that some researchers wanted to track the effects of this additional money on the big people that were receiving it. They wanted to see what kind of changes might arise from this happening. And so over 20 years, they tracked the lives of these people, and they would ask them questions, basically designed to measure, among other things, personality traits. And they posed the same questions every other year. For a decade, not for 20 years. And they wanted to observe any changes, positive or negative. What they found was really interesting. There was a huge change in the development of the children, in their mm-hmm. well-being. And it was a large change. It lowered the instance, and now I'm quoting from the article, it lowered the instance of behavioral and emotional disorders among the children. But it also boosted two key personality traits that tend to go hand in hand with long-term positive life outcomes. And these are conscientiousness and the other one, agreeableness. So they define conscientiousness as if you don't have it, you tend to lie, break rules, and have trouble paying attention. And agreeableness they define as being feeling comfort around other people and an aptness for teamwork. And both are strongly correlated with what we consider success in adult life. And so what they realized was that the reason these children were changing in this way was because there was a reduction in stress for their parents, simply because the parents weren't struggling economically in the same way. And so they weren't fighting as much. There wasn't as much chaos and a feeling of despair in the home. So it's really a no-brainer. I think we don't need to actually have studies like this to tell us that additional money assured month by month permanently is going to have a positive outcome. But it is really nice to see statistics and to actually see that, yes, this is true. It confirms what we instinctively know.
It's really hard for people who grew up with the mindset that you have to earn every penny you get. And the idea that there's a lot of dignity lost, and that you're not a man or not a woman or not a family person if you can't work every second of your life, not raise your children. But it's interesting that these ideas may or may not have come down from people who actually didn't work every second of their life.
Are you saying that these ideas were being propagated in order to control others?
Well, I wouldn't. I'm not going to. Those are your words. But I feel that you nailed it on the head. I think it's true. If you want to encourage your factory workers to continue going to work, well, then you threaten them by losing their job if they don't show up for work. You know, so that takes away their income, hurts their family, even though the work conditions are deplorable. That's okay. My bottom line matters. So not your household or how your children are getting along. Or you see, and this callousness doesn't fit in the new paradigm for humanity. Humanity actually, people love their children. It doesn't matter who you speak to, rich, poor, medium, middle class. But that's the common factor, love. And when that starts to spread, when we start to recognize that that's actually a magnetic scientific fact proven by, who's that marvelous little guy with the crazy hair? Do you remember the scientist?
Oh, Einstein.
Einstein, that's right. Like attracts like. So magnetism, it's all there. So it's not a far off in the pie in the sky attitude or idea. It's a reality that people experience daily with people they love. Like, it's everywhere. And when strangers help other people out for no reason at all, the word stranger actually become suspect. Maybe they're not a stranger. They're certainly not the moment they finish helping you. So this, sorry, go ahead, Sabina.
No, you. I'd like you to finish your thought first.
Well, no, that's, I mean, I'm just waxing on, I guess.
All right. Well, I just wanted to mention that we have another interesting quote in the chat from Elon Musk. Ultimately, we will have to have some sort of universal basic income. I don't think we're going to have a choice. And you wouldn't think that a capitalist like him would be thinking that way, but clearly he is. So
yeah, he's also a bit of a, you know, an inventor and pioneer. So pioneer thinking is that, right? Pioneer thinking always goes through the wall first, you know, with a lot of ideas, a lot of things, and they manifest it. They make it real. They put it on the concrete world. And that's a great quote.
Well, and we've got this video, I think, coming up of Jimmy Carter, ex-president of the United States, talking about universal basic income, the idea of it.
That's right. I think he's at a press conference for Habitat for Humanity. So go ahead, right. Tim.
So we'll play it up.
So my question to you is, do you believe that everybody should have a basic universal income, and would that help in securing a decent and safe home for every person and their families?
Well, I would certainly like to see everybody have an adequate income on which to live and survive. We have a lucky chance in life living in the United States of America and living in Canada, where the average income for a family is quite high. But we have programs in 80 countries in the world, the Carter Center does, and we travel a lot of our time in Ethiopia and in other countries in Africa and Latin America, where sometimes the income is very low. For instance, we have built homes in South Africa, for instance, and also we have done a lot of work in Liberia. After Liberia went through 16 years of warfare, and we finally got an honest and free democratic election and a peaceful transformation of leadership, we realized that the average person in Liberia only made 50 cents a day. And you could just think for a few minutes how you would try to live on, say, a dollar a day or $2 a day. It would be almost impossible. But those people survive. And one of the things I've found out is that when we underestimate people like that, you know, who have been living in poverty, we say, well, if they worked as hard as I do, you know, they could have provided for their families. Or if they were as ambitious as I was, they could have had a better life. But we have found throughout our Habitat experience and also in our other work at the Carter Center that the people that we look upon sometimes as inferior people are just as hardworking as I am and just as ambitious as I am. And their family values are just as good as mine. So it tends to kind of equalize us with other people that we consider sometimes to be kind of below us. But it doesn't do that by lowering us. It does this by elevating other people.
Wow. Elevating other people is key. That point's at the end, right?
So sorry, my question to you is, do you believe that... everybody should have a basic universal income, and would that...
Sorry about that. Elevating others. And, you know, he mentioned working in South Africa. It reminds me of the African philosophy called Ubuntu, which translates, I am because we are. And it talks about our interconnectedness. You know, one can only grow and progress through the growth and progression of others. You know, if others are suffering, then we suffer. So looking out, Nelson Mandela was asked about an example of Ubuntu once. And he said, you know, if a traveler could stop in a village, he decides to stop in a village. He is given food and water by the village just by stopping in. So that's a manifestation of Ubuntu. It's the spirit of Ubuntu. So togetherness and a fight for the greater good. It's right. Elevating others speaks to that, I think, very much so, as a universal truth. Another example was there was an anthropologist I read on, you know, social media. He did a little social experiment. He saw there was a group of African children playing and he gathered a big bowl of really delicious fruit and set them, you know, 100 yards away, set the fruit 100 yards away and said to the kids, there's a bowl of fruit over there. First one to get it can have the whole bowl of fruit. And the kids just looked at each other and they held hands and they kind of walked along and danced and sang all the way to the bowl of fruit. And then they ate it together. And he said, well, how come nobody raced to get the bowl of fruit? And they were just astonished at even the suggestion of it. So they are living Ubuntu, or the spirit of Ubuntu. You know, if one has the bowl of fruit while the others, you know, they're suffering, they're not, it's not a demonstration of Ubuntu. So elevating others so that that equalization happens. I think you mentioned equalize in there as well, in our perception of each other as well. And of course you see it in the golden rules in all the major traditions as well, love thy neighbors, thyself, and so on. But yeah, it reminded me of that.
And what country was that in?
Ubuntu.
This little anecdote with the anthropology.
I believe that was in South Africa as well. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there are many African countries that have words for Ubuntu or demonstrate it, but I think it was a bit more popularized in South Africa because of Nelson Mandela.
Well, and this idea of elevating everybody and the common good and how we all benefit from that. We're seeing this in action now with different kinds of initiatives across the world at the level of municipal politicians, which they don't get as much notice in the media. We're usually focused on the leaders of countries, federal politicians, or maybe provincial. But at the municipal level, there's a lot happening. I ran across this on the internet. It's a mayor's dialogue on growth and solidarity. 20 plus cities are involved. It was started by the mayor of Milan, who reached out to other mayors with the idea that we need to help each other in this time of the pandemic. We need to work together in order to bring this kind of crisis to change how we're living through the crisis. And so these right now are mayors across Europe and Africa, and they're basically working together and they're pooling their efforts and resources to contribute in key areas. And if we go on to the next slide, you'll see I've just got a little list of the key areas.
I think we call this the trickle-up effect, right? When we were all talking about it, that the fact that mayors come up with these incredible ideas, they work with the people immediately around them, affecting right like face-to-face with municipal, so it's always like on a very local level. And then, of course, along comes the state or provincial leaders who like have an ear to it and go, hey, that's a great idea. So then they consider it provincially. Then that, of course, pops it way back up to the federal. So once again, I think it's a great example, Sabina, that grassroots is what changes the world, right? Human beings change the world, not down, but up.
That's right. Yeah. And if we go to the next slide, you'll just see a few of these key effort areas, green economies, housing, local governance. So they're really working on the basics and they're sharing their skills. They're sharing their situations in each different place, what each one can provide. And it's very inspiring. We're going to have a link up for that one as well. This is something that was reported on by the London School of Economics. And so what's interesting, it's being reported on by a major institution, but it's not the institution that initiated it. It's the people on the ground who really started this and are running with it. They're the ones doing it. There's another mayor's initiative that I wanted to also talk about, the Mayor's Roundtable. This is from a couple of years ago, and it was sponsored or put up by the Sanders Institute. And here you had mayors from various cities sharing their experience in bringing things to the ground, again, going from theory to implementation. And you can actually watch the conversation of these people on Facebook, on the Facebook page of the Sanders Institute. And it's really interesting just to hear what they have to say, what they've done in each of their cities and how they're sharing that information. And there is a link for that already up in the chat, the Mayor's Roundtable, it's right there. So these are just a few. There are tons and tons of initiatives right now taking place across the world. So the inspiring thing is to realize, wow, we're really doing it. You know, it's not just theory. People are taking action.
Amazing initiatives everywhere. And I mean, and to be able to deal with these crises. And we're talking about human rights here, of course. We are entering a time where we need to manifest and recognize everyone's dignity, everyone's sacredness, everyone's need to have all of their needs met. And there's more. It's an incredible time right now, incredible time of opportunity, incredible time to create this new future, as we're going to talk about change of ages and also the great teachers that are emerging to help us during this time. And for them, this is a priority as well, about establishing right human relations. It's a priority to make sure that we all have our basic needs met, and so we can grow and evolve.
Well, and I think what's interesting to think about is that what we're seeing is action on the ground now in a way that it just wasn't happening before. The ideas have been there for forever, perhaps. And for example, universal basic income was being talked about already quite a long time ago. But now people are actually putting it into action on the ground. And that, for me, is the big change, is that we're capable now, perhaps because of the change in technology. I'm sure that has a large role to play. And the fact that we have this shared awareness through the media that we can see what's happening in different places.
This Article 25, when they wrote it, I mean, you could imagine the extraordinariness of putting this piece of work together. And the thoughts were implementation. Like, but you can't implement this until people actually grow inwardly, until humanity grows. And we're not talking height or width, as some people's diets can sometimes permit. We're actually speaking about consciousness, growing inside, recognizing your heart, being a part of that. And that's really where humanity has finally reached. They're at this stage now, in my opinion, as when I look around or talk to people, that they're going, well, you know, we all matter. We all count. And that's where Article 25 has been waiting for, because you can't enforce that. That has to come from people. And when they start saying, well, excuse me, I think I have a right here. Well, don't think about it. You do. There's no question. And that's the big shock that's rippling around the world, is no, you don't have to be poor. No, you don't have to be starving. Starving is the greatest crime on planet Earth. We have, 10% surplus of food? We talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? That's an enormous amount of food not going to people who are hungry. Why? To mention at the beginning of the show, profit margin. If it's got to always keep the profit margin, we've got to all work together to change that. We've got to change that profit margin. We've got to recognize that people before profit is not just a nice slogan. It's an actual thing that's going to happen, is happening, as Sabina said today. It's changing. Because
we're doing it now. I mean, it's actually taking place. And one thing that we mentioned during these during these programs is that it's a change of age. We're actually going through a change in the types of energies that are impacting us right now, and that this is very much part of why we're seeing the changes in people's actions and the change in the way people relate to what they hear on the news and what they see. Rather than feeling helpless and just a victim of what's taking place, people are stepping out and saying, I'm going to take action. I'm going to do something about this. And I'll join up with others of like mind. And then we see these great initiatives taking place. And that's something that we say a lot of it is because of the change of the energies that we're being impacted by, from the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius. They're very different energies, and they're stimulating us in very different ways. And so the fact of Aquarius means that these energies are stimulating our ability to work together, our desire to work together, our sense of connectedness. Tim, what you were talking about, Ubuntu, this feeling of being part of something greater than ourselves. And that is being stimulated and is growing and is becoming much more prominent. And we're seeing the results of that on the ground.
Now, Sabina, with every age, there comes somebody to introduce the age, right? Someone comes along to introduce the age to humanity, to give them sort of the Cole's notes as to what's about to happen, where they come from, and where they're headed. If because free will is sacred, if they're willing to embrace it, if they're willing to put it into practice, actually do it.
Well, and we talk about some of the people who've been spreading the information, the ideas about this transition through the Ageless Wisdom teachings. These four people are disciples of the Masters of Wisdom, and we mention them almost every time that we do a program because their writings are so important and so fundamental in explaining what we are going through right now and how this relates to the overall plan for evolution on the earth. And so we encourage everybody to read up if you're interested. The writings of these people are extremely inspiring and profound. The most recent person in this kind of list is Benjamin Krem, who passed away just recently. And I think perhaps his books are the most readable of all. And he was also the editor of Share International magazine. And that magazine is published 10 times a year, combines information about our intrinsic nature as souls and why we're incarnating over and over on the earth, and political and economic news, current events, how that all connects with these changes that we're going through, this change of era, and the changes in the way people think and feel.
That's right. Sorry, we changed slides.
Oh, did you want to say more?
No, it's good. No. The Master's Wisdom. So the Masters are the custodian of the planet of evolution on Earth. Well, Tim, what were you going to say about the Masters?
Well, we were talking about great teachers coming forward at change of ages, and just want to say on the change of age front, somebody has posted, it's amazing how people are saying no worldwide. And of course, you have this in that transition time where you have the old energies and the new energies at play. So some are holding on to old ways and some are working into new. So I just wanted to address that. But knowing that there are the Masters of Wisdom who are our elders who have evolved out of the human kingdom. So they're here to help with that transition as well. The Masters have mastered themselves. They're not masters over anyone. They're in full respect of free will. They're here to inspire and guide. And as Mike was saying, there's always a great teacher coming forward at every change of age. So it's expected that there'll be a great teacher for this age as well, the age of Aquarius. And in fact, what's exciting is there's Maitreya, the world teacher, who is in the world right now in the physical plane, along with several Masters of Wisdom that we're talking about here. So it's going to be a group of masters headed by Maitreya in the world to help humanity with this stage. And they are custodians of the plan of evolution. They're aware of all the energies at play, the energy of the constellations, cosmic energies, and so on. They're aware, because they've evolved out of the human kingdom, they know all the ups and downs that we're experiencing. They know the human experience. They know it very well. So they're very in tune with that, very in tune with a plan for humanity and for the world.
I'd like to just jump in briefly. We have a greeting from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Miriam Kabalan is watching from way over there. So we want to say hi and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, the Masters of the Wisdom, like Tim said, they're basically, well, they are. Before they were Masters of Wisdom, they were people just like ourselves, suffering day in, day out with different choices, inwardly and outwardly, different conflicts of political systems, economic systems of their times. And then, like Tim said, they gradually master themselves. And that's why they're the Masters of Compassion and Wisdom. And they're returning to the physical plane for the first time in 98,000 years. So they're here, they're in the world, and they're they're, Tim, you were reading something about that the other day. We had a chance to chat about them returning to the world, and they were part of the whole picture and how they were doing it. Do you remember that? It's a bit of a reach.
Their return to the world, to the everyday world, is part of their evolution as well. That is,
and service.
Yeah, the process of evolution doesn't stop. It's not like you reach a point and then you're done. We keep evolving forever. It's intrinsic to life. And so the masters are also in a constant process of evolution, just as we are. And this is the next step for them to do this. And I think we have a quote from one of the masters. This was Benjamin Krem's master. And I think it's important to remember that our perspective is probably not very complete when we look at ourselves or we look at the world. I like to refer to how the masters see us. And this is from one of the articles that Benjamin Krem's master relayed to him telepathically over the years that they worked together. And it's called Victory is Assured from 1984. And these are just a few sentences. Gradually, the good is gaining the upper hand in this age-old struggle for the minds and hearts of men. The fact that that's what they see, that that's what the masters of wisdom see, that, I think, is really important, because we down here, sort of to put it right on the ground, we may only see partially. We see bits and pieces. We just see what we're able to see. But they have an overview. They have like a holographic view. And so if they say that that's what's happening, I really believe it. I think it's true. And he goes on to say that to some, this may seem an astonishing statement to make in the light of the tensions and cleavages in the world. But he affirms that's the case. And if you could see the world the way we do, you would see that this world is undergoing an extraordinary transformation. On all sides, there's evidence that the old order is crumbling. And he agrees, ancient hatreds divide the peoples and lawlessness abounds, but everywhere there are signs that a new spirit is awakening in man, a new sense of responsibility, and a renewed reverence for life in all its form. And I think this is what we're seeing, this new spirit awakening, this sense of responsibility and reverence for life. We're seeing people acting on that. And that's the thing that's so inspiring and empowering. And we have another hello from Chris Varma in San Francisco.
Sairam, Chris.
Sairam, Chris. I just want to say, just on that point, the master, in case we didn't cover it, I think we did in an earlier show, but I'll just quickly say, is telepathically in contact with Benjamin Krem while he was alive. So he was enabled to get those letters, if you will, or messages telepathically. And then Benjamin Krem, of course, would write it down. And it would appear, as Sabina said, in 10 issues of Share International magazine. So you would have this opportunity to hear the thoughts of a master of wisdom who's part of this huge group who are, the only thing they want to do is uplift humanity. They only want to make our lives better, fair, just. They want to create a state called right relationship with ourselves and each other. So this
and
slide,
I'm sure that they're still in telepathic contact now that Benjamin Krem has transitioned, right? I'm sure that continues because the masters are always in telepathic contact with each other, and that's how they work.
Right. Yeah. So here we are with this slide, my Tree of the World teacher, right? So Tim was talking about that. Sabina?
Yeah, we could talk a bit more about Maitreya. He's in the world, as we were talking about, along with a group of masters to help during this time. He'll be here for the Age of Aquarius to guide us and inspire us. He's got a set of priorities. He holds the position of the Christ. It's kind of like president. He embodies love for the planet, but it's not in any way you would think in a regular as a leader. He is, the masters would call him master. He has evolved to a further level, if you will, and taken on more responsibility.
When you say that it's not leader the way we would think of it, I think that's really important, because our concept of a leader is based in the Piscean age, and the idea that a leader is someone who tells everybody else what to do or tells everyone how things are. And what we understand from the way Benjamin Krem and the other exponents of the Ageless Wisdom teaching, the way they've described the relationships among the masters of wisdom, and with Maitreya, who's the elder brother, if you will, of the masters, it's quite different. It's what you were just saying about increased responsibility. The more awareness a person has, the more responsibility they have. And responsibility is really the ability to respond. So when you have greater awareness, you have greater ability to respond, and then it's incumbent upon you to do that, to respond. And so what we see is that a leader in this sense is someone who responds more and who takes on more, if you will.
Yeah, Sabina, Maitreya is exactly right. He responds to every human being's heart, right? So he can feel everybody's suffering and pain, all the anguish going on. He knows also the joy, the magic moments that are being experienced. He's in tune with every human being's heart. And so if you think about that for a minute, that puts you in a great position, especially with Sabina's definition, to help, to be of service, to lead by example, to be boots on the ground, walking the streets. He's even said in one of his messages, "I've walked the pavements of your cities." So he is all over this world doing what he can, where he can, every moment of every day to help bring about and make these changes manifest physically in the world.
But we're the ones who are going to do the work to make the changes. He said in one of his messages, he may be the architect of the plan, but we're the builders. We're the people who actually do it. Because if we don't do it, and if someone else does it for us, we'll just keep doing what we're doing, which will inevitably lead to going right back to where we are now. So it has to be us, does it?
Yeah. So in turn, we, as we were talking about responsibility and responding, we can in turn respond to all the great energies available right now, great opportunities, and take part in that.
And the great ideas, yeah.
Exactly. That's our opportunity to do exactly that.
So Maitreya fulfills the expectations of the world's major religions for the return of a great teacher in some future time. However, he says that this is not how he mostly wants to be known. He prefers to be known just as a teacher in the broadest sense. He says he's here for everybody, both people who are within a religious tradition and those who are not. And he's not here to start a new religion in any sense at all. He's here to teach the art of self-realization, which is a path that's open to everybody, simply because we are. It's not related to any particular belief system. And we've done some programs on the art of self-realization and Maitreya's teachings. We'll probably go back to that in the future, just because it's so fruitful. But right now, I think what we want to do is go ahead to Maitreya's priorities, because in addition to teaching the art of self-realization, what really concerns him is the suffering, as you were saying, Mike, of so many people who don't have enough even to eat. And so his first priority is that, the ending of hunger. And if you look at this list of priorities we've got up on the screen right now, it's almost exactly the same as Article 25 from the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So you can see that humanity is responding. We are picking up the ideas, and the big change now is we're putting them into action.
This show is called What in the World is Happening? And is a live stream that takes place weekly every Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, with co-hosts Sabina Qureshi and Tim Butskis. To get notifications about this show, follow Share International Canada on Facebook. That's Share International Canada on Facebook. This is David Monat II, and this show was brought to you by PlanetaryMakeover.org. Special thanks to Silito Pasquale, Sabina Qureshi, and Tim Butskis. See you in 2 weeks.